first of all, you look at U2, and they have now won more Grammy Awards than any band in history. They split their economic profits five equal ways. That surprises a lot of people. And then finally, the element we call knowledge flow or voice is present too. They have, the way they make creative decisions is they take a very consensus-oriented approach.
Welcome to the Alter Group Podcast on Real Estate. I'm your host, Tom Silva. Our guests today are Michael Lee Stallard and Jason Pankow, co-founders of E Pluribus Partners, the world's leading experts in building connection cultures within organizations. Michael, I'd like you to open by telling us why you think building a connection culture is important.
Well, it's the thing you see across the research, Tom, about what really makes us happy is the connection, that relationships we have in the workplace and out of the workplace really have the greatest impact on happiness, or something that Jason and I like to talk about a little bit more about is what we feel, the sense of joy is even more important than a transient sense of happiness.
Now, the skeptics in the audience might think that that sounds very amorphous and sort of new agey, but it's really been substantiated, hasn't it?
Our work has really received a boost in recent years from the research of some other organizations. The Conference Board, which is a well-respected group out of New York City that has most of the top companies in the U.S. are a part of the Conference Board.
So given the currency of this idea of a connection culture, Jason, maybe you can help us define what exactly connection is.
We define connection. Just let's talk about this, the concept of connection. Connection, we say, is a bond based on a shared identity, empathy, and understanding that moves self-centered individuals toward group-centered membership. So that's our kind of quickie definition of what connection is, because we talk about connection culture so much. It's a bond based on a shared identity, the sense of we are doing something together, we're one, we're part of the same team. Empathy, that when I hurt, you hurt. When I'm happy, you're happy. We celebrate with one another. We're empathetic, not just sympathetic. And understanding, that we're listening to each other's thoughts. We're wanting to share the, you know, and tap into our corporate mind, not just care about what I have in my head. And we want to really give everybody a sense of voice, we call it, that moves self-centered people toward this group-centered membership.
So, Jason, can you outline for us very briefly how we get to a connection culture?
And we came up with, throughout those 5-6 years of research, we came up with 5 elements that we believe create this connection culture. And there's 3 core elements, and then 2 what we call enabling elements. The 3 core elements are what we call inspiring identity, human value, and knowledge flow. So again, inspiring identity, it kind of mirrors the definition. If do we have this corporate sense of identity that engages us, that inspires us, that makes us want to show up and give our very best every day? So that's inspiring identity, and we can give you the more formal definitions of that later if you want to dig into each one. The second, human value, which when we diagram our model is right in the middle of the model. Human value is when we are treating each other, we're valuing one another just because we're human, just because we're breathing, if you will, not just for what I can get from you. Again, one of the things we're seeing more and more is that we're treating each other like human doings, not human beings, in the way we're relating. So we're finding people that care about others only insofar as they can get something from them. And the second that they see that they're not able to get something from them, they start to lose interest. So they're not really valuing them for being a human being. They're valuing them solely for, what can you bring to the table? Okay, if you can't bring anything, okay, I'm moving on. And it's a very disconnecting, isolating, relational way to relate. The third is knowledge flow. And this is when, what we like to say, we're tapping the corporate mind. We're letting knowledge flow throughout the organization. We're sharing our ideas. We're seeking ideas. We're doing that in a way that continues to make us want to relate to another. So not going around nuking people with all the truth and not doing it in a relationally sensitive way so that the knowledge will flow. So those are the core elements. An inspiring identity makes me want to show up and give my best. I'm going to be related to in a way that I know I'm cared for here. And then they're going to want to hear what I have to say, and I'm going to want to listen to what they have to say. When great leaders help create environments where this was happening, connection happened. And the productivity soared. And again, these are the stories that we talk about throughout history where, wow, look at that amazing thing that happened. How did that happen? Well, yeah, part of it was task excellence, but a lot of it was the way they related to one another, the way they stuck together, the kind of community that was built there. That's what made it succeed. So those are the three what we call core elements: inspiring identity, human value, knowledge flow. And then there are the two enabling elements, what we call committed members and then servant leaders. Now, there's been a lot written about the idea of servant leadership. And again, Jim Collins is very good. Scientifically, it's showing that these are the kind of leaders that build superior performance over time, no doubt about it. And that's a sure need to create a connection culture. You absolutely have to have leaders that are there to model the way and mentor others in the way. They're there to help build and grow others. But then the thing that was really, I don't know if startling is the right word, but it was just crystal clear in our research that in what we define as committed members, we define them as people committed to task excellence, committed to connection culture, but committed to character strengths as well. It was very clear that there was a certain kind of person, somebody with these kinds of character strengths, and we use the 24 character strengths and virtues from Seligman and Peterson out of the positive psychology movement as our character strengths that we promote as well. And those kind of people are people who connect. It's a very clear relationship. We actually created a flow chart that we call the character connection thrive chain. That people with positive character strengths, they do build connection, and that connection meets our universal human needs, which helps us all thrive, both individually and corporately. So that's just a quick snapshot of the connection culture and kind of what it's all about.
All right, so I want to jump from the theory into some real-life examples, and number one on my list to ask you about is U2. Irish rock band, of course, formed in Dublin, 1976. Bono, The Edge, Adam Clayton, Larry Mullen. Tell me about why U2 is a great example of a connection culture.
First of all, you look at U2, and they have now won more Grammy Awards than any band in history. And they've also been together for more than 30 years, which is quite an accomplishment when you look at the success they've had and often how the impact of success, how success impacts performers and egos and just the subsequent breakdown in relationships that occurs. But they really are an exception to what generally happens. And to understand their story, you have to go back to how the band got together in Dublin, Ireland. The four teenagers met Bono. When he was 14 years old, his mother passed away. He describes her as the lovely Iris when he talks about her, which shows just the affection he had for his mom. And during that time, his father was so grief-stricken that he was unable to be there to console his son. So Bono, as a 14-year-old boy, grieved alone, very difficult for an adolescent to do. Then a couple years later, when Larry Mullen Jr., the drummer of the band, when his mother passed away, Bono reached out to him and said, I know what you're going through, and I'm going to be there for you. You're not going to go through this alone. It developed a friendship, a bond between the two young teenagers. Larry actually was the guy who started the band, and later the other members joined in. And quite a few years later, Edge, the lead guitar player, his wife left him, and they were divorced, and that was a very difficult emotional situation for him. The guys were there to help him get through that. Then Adam Clayton, the bass player, at one point developed a drug and alcohol addiction that he battled for 5 years. He even missed one of the concerts that they were playing, and that was an inflection point in U2's history when they had to decide, do we let this guy go who hung us out to dry? He didn't even show up for the concert. Fortunately, they had someone who knew his part who slipped in and played the bass guitar. But they all have a passion for excellence, so it was no small matter that that he missed the concert. And they decided that they adopted the motto that no one gets left behind. that we're all going to get through this alive, and they decided they're going to stick with him. And they helped him overcome that drug and alcohol addiction. And perhaps the most dramatic example occurs some years later when they were playing a concert in Arizona and received a death threat that said, if you play the song Pride, which is about, or In the Name of Love, is what most people would recognize the song by, it's about the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And the note said that if you play that song, Bono will die. But the guys decided they weren't going to back down, and they performed the song. Bono closed his eyes as he sang the song, and at the end of one verse, he opened his eyes. To his surprise, he literally saw Adam Clayton standing in front of him to shield his friend from harm. Some years later, when U2 was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Bono mentioned that Adam was willing to take a bullet for me. Well, he wasn't kidding. Adam literally was standing in front of him at that concert, so that was no joke. They're very, very close. You see it in so many ways. That just shows how they value one another. You also see that they value one another. Bono talks about, he certainly had opportunities to leave the band and go off on a solo career, but he says, I'm a lousy guitar player and a lousy keyboards player. I hear music in my head, but without these talented friends and musicians, I'm not able to bring it to life. And in addition to that, these guys help make me a better human being. Why would I ever want to leave the group for more money? God only knows I have enough money already. And so he's very committed to his fellow band members. And you see that sense of what we call, what Jason talked about, human value, or value for short.
And of course, that sense of value extends to their concern with the world around them, in particular, debt relief for Africa, as an example.
Yeah, Tom, I'm glad you brought that up. That that touches on the element of inspiring identity or vision. Bono calls it the spark. He says, we're performers, certainly, but we think of ourselves more as traveling salespeople because we're promoting human rights and social justice. And for us, that is the spark that makes the difference. It's not just about entertaining people. We have a point of view that we're trying to communicate and move people to action.
And what else do you think that U2 is doing right as far as creating connection?
I should mention that they split their economic profits 5 equal ways. That surprises a lot of people, that the 4 band members and their long-term manager, Paul McGinnis, share in that equal profit split. That also makes them feel valued as members of the U2 community. And then finally, the element we call knowledge flow or voice is present too. They have, the way they make creative decisions is they take a very consensus-oriented approach. It reminds me of Quaker practice, that if one of the members strongly opposes the direction they're going in or a decision they're making, then they're committed not to going in that direction, not making that particular decision. They all have to be willing to go forward or at least not strongly oppose the direction that the other band members want to go in.
Jason, one of the supreme examples of leadership in our age, at least one that's always talked about, is Steve Jobs at Apple. Can you talk a little bit about him as far as it relates to building a sense of connection?
Well, I mean, when you look at, again, our core elements, inspiring identity, human value, knowledge flow. Inspiring identity, he's probably one of our poster child for inspiring identity. He comes in and he casts a very compelling vision. The part that he is weak on, and again, we've known people that have worked for Apple and all that, is probably the human value element, right? He drives people into the ground has been the take on him. And I think that, after he got, let go and then they brought him back, I think that there was a shift towards more human value. For sure, and then with his recent cancer scare, I mean, you wonder if it's not getting better and better over time. I don't have any hands-on data for that in the past couple of years to know how he's shifting and changing, but, he keeps that inspiring identity pulse of Apple just beating very strong. And, he understands that people's vision has to be lifted beyond, hey, we're just technologists. No. We're giving people the tools to create the future. We're going to build such amazing, beautiful machines. I mean, You want to be a part of that. He's great at creating what we call, you know, people who are proud of the reputation. You know, people are proud to have worked for Apple. You know, they're motivated by the mission, united by the values, and proud of the reputation. That's our definition for inspiring identity. And I think he does a great job of creating that.
Michael, somebody else I want to ask you about is Admiral Vernon E. Clark, Chief of Naval Operations for the United States Navy.
Yeah, that's a great story. I'm glad you brought that up. We were speaking at Lockheed Martin Aerospace, and the former commander of the 5th Fleet, Willie Moore, who used to be the oldest Navy flyer at one time, came up afterward and said, "Wow, I want to introduce you to the former chief of the Navy because he did what you're talking about, and we saw a measurable impact on the Navy's first-term reenlistment." So Willie put us in touch with Admiral Clark, and we interviewed a number of admirals at the Pentagon and over the telephone, those who had dispersed outside of who were no longer in the Navy. And met with Admiral Clark and his wife for like 3.5 hours one time down in the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C., and learned this great story about a leader who Admiral Clark became the Chief of Navy Operations in 2000. And this was a time when the Navy was struggling a bit. A former Chief of the Navy had committed suicide. Just morale was down. First-term reenlistment was below the Navy's goal of 38%. And Admiral Clark came in, and he made winning the war on talent his number one priority. He had what he called his top five priorities. Winning the war on talent was number one, or people. He recognized that the retention problem really was with the enlisted class of the Navy. You have the officers and the enlisted class. He realized he needed to focus on the enlisted class. The officers, for the most part, felt connected and were engaged. So he went out and he spoke to the master chiefs, who were the leaders in the enlisted class. And I remember my conversation with the former chief, head of the master chiefs, and he said, he just described it, and he was so enthusiastic about what Admiral Clark did that he went out and, as a chief of Navy operations, met with the master chiefs, groups of master chiefs around the world. And he shared this story. He said that when I first became chief on my first ship, I was so green that I didn't know the blunt end of the ship from the pointy end of the ship, number one. And I had this master chief on board by the name of Leedy, who, after about a week on board, he came up to me, put his arm on me, and he said, "You know, Mr. Clark, I like you, and I'm going to help make you a fine officer." And he said this experienced, wise master chief mentored him and helped make him a better leader that really had an impact on him. And he asked the master chiefs, he said, "I need you, master chiefs, I know who's running the Navy, and I need you to do what Chief Leedy did for me. Our sailors, they come into the Navy, they pledge to support and defend the U.S. Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic, but what do we as the leaders pledge to them? We need to pledge that we will give them the training, the encouragement, the resources they need to live up to their pledge. And if we do that, Katie, bar the door, because we will have so many people who want to be in the Navy, we won't know what to do with them." And Admiral Clark, this wasn't just talk. He made a huge investment in building corporate training to improve the skills of the sailors. He put procedural and processes in place to support this goal. For example, he required in performance reviews that the managers had to show how they were improving the skills and capabilities of the sailors under their leadership. And he also put in, they used to have what they called slamming in the Navy, that people didn't have much input into where they would serve or in what position. And he changed that, reorganized it into somewhat of, I think of it as a reverse eBay bidding system, where as long as a person was qualified, they could bid on positions around the world and in location, particular locations and positions. And so they reduced slamming from about 30% to under 1.5%. And this showed the sailors they valued them, and they gave them a voice in where they would serve. 18 months after Vern Clark became the Chief of Navy Operations, the Navy's first-term reenlistment rose from under 38% to 56.7%. Within 2 years, the Navy had more sailors than they knew what to do with. So when 9/11 happened, the Navy was well prepared from a personnel standpoint to respond quickly to the threat. And it was just in a matter of hours before the Navy was in position to defend our shores.
Another person I want to ask you about, Michael, is Vineet Nair, who's Vice Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of HCL Technologies.
Sure. He's, what a great example. He's amazing, and HCL Technologies is getting a lot of press these days. What I'm so impressed about Nair and what HCL is doing is they're bringing transparency. They're really great at putting systems and programs in place that bring vision, value, and voice connection culture to their employees. Well, number one, their philosophy is employees first, customers second, because they believe that if management serves the employees and employees understand that they have to serve customers, then employees will give their best efforts, they'll align their behavior with organizational goals, and therefore customers will be better served, and of course customers will satisfy the economic objectives of the organization. So they're putting all kinds of processes in place. Let me just mention a couple. One that they have is they encourage supervisors to make the results of their performance reviews public, and Vineet Nair has done it himself. So you can see where his opportunities for development are and where his strengths are. All the employees can see that. It's all available on their intranet. And I believe it's about 75% of the supervisors have done that. They also rate internal service providers in terms of just speed of response and quality of response. So they're putting a lot of metrics in place that really measure some of the things that we think reflect character strengths in the organization. Are people responsive? Are they, is your supervisor caring and helping you learn and grow? So they're really taking it to the next level. And Gary Hamel, the management thinker, has raised awareness of HCL Technologies' work, and we feel it fits very consistent with what we talk about in our connection culture model.
Jason, somebody we would be remiss in not talking about is our president. Give us a sense of how you think President Obama has done in creating connection.
I think it's hard to net it out so quickly. I think you got to give him a couple more years to really see how this thing all plays out. But obviously, during his campaigning, he was somebody who could create that inspiring identity. He definitely can speak well. He can cast vision. So we would probably give him high marks on creating inspiring identity, getting people to believe in that cause and rally around a cause. So that's probably a positive for him. He seems to be somebody who can connect in terms of human value. He seems to be somebody who can make that human connection and cares for that. I don't know how good he is with knowledge flow, although, he seems to want to get a lot of good thinkers in the room and listen to them. I think on the appearance side, he looks strong in terms of connection from our vantage point. In that way, he seems to have a servant leader perspective, and he seems to want to have character strengths himself. So on the surface, I say he comes off as a connector.
So looking across all of these people we've talked about, what can we say about them? What connects them in terms of their character and their the psychology behind these personalities?
Yeah, I would start this kind of discussion by going back to those character strengths. These 24 character strengths that have been identified by the positive psychology movement and are pointed to as these are the kind of strengths that we think lead to life, basically. These make people alive, thriving human beings. Now, when you can have somebody with those character strengths, probably the preeminent character strength being humility, and they're able to be thoughtful and creative and cast vision that you see is not just them-centered, is an us-centered, beyond us vision, then you've got a leader, right? You've got somebody who we want to be like, they've got good character, and they want to help us get there. They want to help us move from here to there, but they do it in a way where they're modeling the way, and then they're mentoring us in that way. And, you know, there is that public persona that you can pull that off, you know, on camera and in big settings. But, you know, one way or another, it's going to always come down to the one-on-one relationships. What are they really like? And that's when I think that the real leaders show up. It's the real leaders who can make those personal connections. They truly are connectors that care about people. You know, one of the greatest leaders probably over the past 100 years is who Peter Drucker defined as one of the greatest leaders he ever saw, Francis Hesselbein. Somebody that most people probably, she's kind of drifting into history right now, but Francis Hesselbein took over the Girl Scouts of America when it was basically floundering and almost gone, and built it into such a vibrant organization. They had 750,000 volunteers when she left it after, I think it was 25-year run. And Peter Drucker looked at her and said, she is one of the greatest leaders I have ever seen. They had over a paid staff of 6,000 when she left. I mean, she built this thing, yes, on task excellence, but she was such an amazing connector personally. We know her. She's a friend of ours. She supports our work. But when you go into her office right there, you know, in New York City on Park Avenue, it's like mom on steroids. She is just connecting with you, and she's got her whole staff, and they're running. She now runs what used to be called the Peter Drucker Foundation, which is now called the Leader to Leader Institute. You know, Peter Drucker handpicked her to run that for him. And, you know, it's just an amazing example of what connection can do, you know, and mobilize and catalyze people. She's probably one of the best leaders to study, you know.
What do you think all great leaders share?
The great leaders want more accountability over their lives as they grow, not less. The leaders that don't create connection use their position and authority to outstrip authority and don't want people holding them accountable. They want to have free rein and do it their way and kind of become the dictator boss and all that. And they can do it with a really nice smile on their face, too. So it looks all syrupy. One of my mentors used to call it saccharin. You know, it's the fake sugar. You know, look out for the saccharin, he used to say. And so what we find is there an appropriate accountability? Are people being mentored at every level of the organization? And are they being held accountable? And the higher you go, it's a privilege, but you need more accountability, not less, because there's more riding on your performance. And so you should have the willingness to let your life be scrutinized more and more the higher you go in the hierarchy.
Michael, tell us about the Gallup Q12 poll that was done in 2002, which I think is very important to this discussion.
Sure. Well, Gallup has been surveying employee engagement for quite a long time now, and they have a lot of good longitudinal data. And the instrument they use is called the Q12. One of the things we looked at when we were doing our research was looking at the different employee engagement surveys out there and what they measured. And the Q12 is probably the most used survey in employee engagement. They had tested a lot of questions and narrowed it down to 12 that provided the greatest degree of predictability in terms of employee engagement. And it's fascinating when you dissect those questions. It just has connection all over it. The most impactful question, and this is the one that provides, we hear from clients and leaders in corporations that they have the greatest problem with is, do I have a friend, a best friend in the workplace? And the response we hear from many executives is, well, I can't control that, so why are you measuring me as a leader in creating an environment that where best friends, friendships develop? When that's not something I can control, so I shouldn't be held accountable for it. But that just reflects the statistical predictability of that particular question, and it shows how important connection is. Other questions they have in the Q12 are, does my supervisor care for me? Do I feel respected by my colleagues, that my opinion is heard and considered, which is, you know, the factor we call voice or knowledge flow. So when you dissect the Q12, you see all these different examples of connection. And in the longitudinal data that Gallup has, we see that on average about 75%, and there are other measures of this that other organizations have done, it's by and large pretty consistent that about 75% of employees over time have reported that they're not engaged. And that's true of today, it's true of 10 years ago. There have been some slight changes here and there. And a lot of people think, well, is employee engagement or disengagement so high because of the Great Recession? And the truth is that it's actually the slide down in employee engagement that's occurred over a long period of time. It started occurring long before the Great Depression or the Great Recession. I shouldn't say depression. Gallup's research is very good, but there's also research by the Corporate Executive Board and Hewitt and a number of other parties, and it's very consistent in terms of you see these roughly 3 out of 4 employees are not engaged. And it just shows the flip side of that is there's a huge opportunity to improve engagement and productivity and innovation as well.
So, Michael, it seems to me if you're an employee, you have to wait for your management team to issue a directive in order for there to be connection, correct?
You as an individual can have a huge impact on connection, because when you look at the research, what you see is there is a large dispersion within almost every organization between work groups. You find some work groups that are highly engaged, people feel connected, they're highly productive, they're highly creative, they have great energy, and then you may walk down the hall, Tom, and find a work group that they're in an environment that's literally draining the life out of them. You can just see it on their faces, and yet those work groups are that close. The leader at the top, of course, it's ideal to have a leader at the top of the organization who embraces connection and employee engagement, but it's not necessary. One of the examples I used earlier was Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, just the experience that we had when my wife was going through cancer treatments. We felt very connected, and we could see that there was a high degree of connection among the people who worked at that particular building of Sloan Kettering. We had a friend who contracted a different type of cancer about a year later, and we encouraged her to go to Sloan Kettering. She went to a different building because she had a different type of cancer, and she described her first visit there as feeling it made her feel alone and unwelcome. And she told me she would never return again. She ended up going to Yale New Haven Health System for treatment. So the bottom line of that, in terms of actionability, is all of us can have an impact on connection among the work group that we interact with on a day-in and day-out basis. And that's actually the most important group in terms of connection, is just who are those group of people that we interact with on a day-in and day-out basis.
And finally, I wanted to ask you both to tell me a little bit about what the prospects are for being able to foster connection both in our workplace and in the rest of our lives. What do you see as you look ahead?
You know, one thought that comes to mind for me is just, you know, we could be in a very exciting time in our country's development. One of the things I've come to believe about human development is that most people won't make changes until the pain threshold in their lives gets to the point where they have to. And I kind of feel like corporate America might be getting to that point where they're going, we've got to do something different. And the good news is we've got lots of historical examples to learn from. It's just going back to the relational excellence, the creating these connection cultures, will not only make us more productive again and more profitable and all that, but it'll help us enjoy the journey along the way. And for one of the most productive societies ever, our happiness scores should be through the roof. We should be grateful and celebrate all that we have rather than being stuck and mired in, you know, kind of depression the way too many people are.
Michael and Jason, I wanted to thank you for joining us on the program. It was truly a pleasure having you.
Yeah, Tom, we just want to also just celebrate the work you're doing and helping being part of the solution here, changing corporate culture.
To listen to more Alta Group podcasts or to read our AltaNow blog, visit www.altagroup.com.